Welcome to History in a Year, America's first 250 years.
Join us every single day as we journey from the Revolution of 1776 to the 250th anniversary of the United States.
You can find every episode and join the discussion at pointedwords.com. I'm Stephen.
And I'm Leah.
It is February 27th. Welcome to episode 58. We have spent the last few days in the political trenches of the year 1800.
We saw the Federalists pass the tyrannical Alien and Sedition Acts. We saw Alexander Hamilton destroy his own party. And we saw a terrifying six-day deadlock in the Electoral College, where militias literally started arming themselves for a civil war.
But today, the fever breaks. The date is March 4th, 1801. It is Inauguration Day in the brand new, half-built, incredibly muddy capital city of Washington, D.C.
And what happens on this day is arguably the greatest achievement of the founding generation. It is the day the American experiment proved it could actually survive.
To understand why this day was so miraculous, you have to zoom out and look at the rest of the world in 1801.
In Europe, power did not change hands via a ballot box. Power changed hands when a king died, or when an army conquered a capital city, or when someone's head was chopped off by a guillotine.
When one faction hated another faction, the loser usually ended up in a dungeon or swinging from a rope. Up until this exact moment in history, there was no precedent for a ruling party voluntarily handing over the keys to the kingdom to their worst political enemies simply because they lost an election.
But that is exactly what happened.
Let's look at the outgoing president, John Adams. He had the military. He had the courts. He had the Sedition Act. If he had wanted to declare martial law and hold on to power, he probably could have tried.
But John Adams was a man of the law. He respected the Constitution far more than his own ego.
However, he was still human, and he was deeply, deeply bitter. He could not bring himself to stand there and watch his former friend, the man who had secretly hired writers to call him a tyrant, take his job.
So in the pitch black early hours of March 4th, at exactly 4 a.m., John Adams boarded a public stagecoach bound for Baltimore. He quietly slipped out of Washington, D.C. before the sun even came up.
He left the presidency behind and went home to his farm in Massachusetts. He wouldn't speak to Thomas Jefferson again for over a decade.
With Adams gone, the stage was set for Thomas Jefferson.
Now think about how George Washington and John Adams handled the presidency. They loved pomp and circumstance. Washington rode around in a magnificent white chariot pulled by six matched horses. Adams wore velvet suits and carried a ceremonial sword.
They wanted the presidency to look dignified. Thomas Jefferson wanted the exact opposite. He wanted the presidency to look like the common man.
So on the morning of his inauguration, Jefferson didn't take a carriage. He didn't have a military parade. He simply walked out of his boarding house, accompanied by a few friends and some local militia members, and walked through the mud down New Jersey Avenue.
He was dressed like a regular citizen. He wore a plain, dark blue suit, completely out of fashion, with practical laced shoes instead of fancy silver buckles.
He walked into the unfinished Capitol building. Only the North Wing was actually completed at this point, and walked into the Senate chamber.
Waiting for him there was the man who had to administer the oath of office, the new Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Marshall.
The irony is incredibly thick here. John Marshall is a hardcore Federalist. He is Jefferson's second cousin, and he absolutely despises him. But it is his constitutional duty to swear him in.
So Marshall holds out the Bible, and Jefferson takes the oath, swearing to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
And then Jefferson delivers his first inaugural address, and it is a masterpiece.
Jefferson knew the country was dangerously divided. The election had almost caused a civil war. He needed to talk the country off the ledge.
He stood before the crowd, and in a very quiet voice, Jefferson was notoriously soft-spoken and hated public speaking. He delivered a plea for unity.
He reminded everyone that political disagreements are not the same as treason. He said, "Every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle."
And then he delivered the most famous line of the speech. He looked out at a room filled with politicians who had spent the last 4 years trying to destroy each other, and he said,
"We have called by different names, brethren of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists."
We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists. He was telling the nation that their shared commitment to the American Republic was stronger than their political parties.
He also used the speech to lay out his vision for the government. And it was a sharp U-turn from the Federalist era.
He promised a wise and frugal government, which shall restrain men from injuring one another, shall leave them otherwise free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement, and shall not take from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned.
Essentially, he was promising a smaller, cheaper, and less intrusive federal government. He wanted to cut taxes, shrink the military, and let the states handle their own business.
The speech was a massive success. It calmed the waters. Even some of his fiercest Federalist critics read it in the newspapers and had to admit that it was perfectly pitched.
When Jefferson walked back to his boarding house that afternoon, the transition of power was officially complete.
This is why Jefferson later referred to his election as the Revolution of 1800. It wasn't a revolution of swords and cannons. It was a revolution of the ballot box.
A political party holding absolute power had surrendered that power peacefully. It proved that the Constitution wasn't just a piece of paper. It was a living system that actually worked in the real world.
But Jefferson's vision of a quiet, small, frugal government was about to run headfirst into a massive, continental-sized opportunity.
Because across the Atlantic Ocean, the most powerful and dangerous man in Europe had just made a decision that would double the size of the United States overnight.
Join us tomorrow for Episode 59, The Louisiana Purchase. We finally step into the back rooms of Paris to witness the greatest real estate deal in human history. We watch as American diplomats try to buy a single port city, only for Napoleon Bonaparte to offer them half a continent.
I'm Leah.
And I'm Stephen. You can find every episode at pointedwords.com. And this is our story.